Accession number 10657, reel 41.
Yes, we arrived safely at Milan. We went through the barrier. Fortunately, you know, our identity cards were not questioned. But we had to stay put on Milan station because there was a curfew in operation. And we had 3 hours to wait for our train, and there were a lot of Germans wandering about all over the place. So we didn't feel entirely at ease. It was quite cold, and it was suggested that we might like a rum punch by our two guides, Mario's brothers. Tony went into the buffet, came back in about 15 minutes, and then I went in. And I had only just got inside the bar, with Aldo, I think it was, when I saw an Italian naval officer standing there and recognised him as the officer who'd been in charge of the landing craft that had taken us from Sicily to the hospital ship. At that time, my head was bandaged and there wasn't very much of my face showing. So there was no way in which he could possibly identify me. But it was a hell of a shock, and I know it was him, because when I'd been on the landing craft, I'd been lying down and I couldn't move my head. I'd been looking in one direction all the time, and it just so happened that he was standing just above and in front of me. So I've been looking at him for quite a while. Anyway, I went outside, I gulped my drink down, went outside, told Tony what I'd seen, and he went whiter than I did, I think, until I explained that there was really no danger about it. Now, just before dawn, Armando, that's one of the two brothers, handed us over with £100 in notes, which had been raised by Mario in Modena, and we were handed over, together with the notes, to a Milan businessman whose job it was to take us on the next stage of the journey. Now, the next train we got was a train of cattle trucks with wooden forms. We were told to get in the truck with the guide, not to speak, go into the corner of the truck and face the end wall. Half an hour out of Milan, the ticket collector came along. I think we must have stopped at a station or something like that, but he got into the truck anyway. It made frequent stops because it was only a little local train, asking for tickets, and I showed him mine. Then he asked me a question which I didn't understand. All the other occupants of the truck were staring hard at us, so not knowing what to say, I simply pointed to the scar on the side of my face, made a few mumbling noises, and one of the two guides then said, "My friend cannot answer. He is deaf and dumb as a result of the war. Is his ticket not in order?" Or words to that effect. Anyway, the collector explained that I'd given up the wrong half of the ticket. So he gave it back, and the explanation was accepted, and all was well. But I'm absolutely certain that the rest of the Italians in that truck knew that we were phonies, if you like, but nothing else happened. And we left the train at a little wayside station and walked along a country road to an isolated house. This was prior to our next stage of the journey, which would be to a village further along the valley. And at 6 o'clock, a villainous looking youngster took us over from the Milan businessman, and we had to go through the woods in almost total darkness to the next staging point, and we weren't too happy about this at all. Tony walked with the guide and I followed behind carrying a cudgel, because we reasoned that having received £100, the Milan businessman, we hadn't seen him give anything to this youngster. It would be very easy for him to knock us off in the woods and then to report back to Modena that we had left Milan and continued our journey safely.
I assume it would also have been easy
Yes, quite easily, quite easily. That's right, that's right, that's it. Anyway, although it was an eerie walk through these woods and along a river bank, we arrived safely at the guide's house. When we talked to him a bit in sort of broken English, French, Italian, whatever, he didn't seem to be a bad chap. And we slept soundly in the house, but I must admit that we jammed the back of a door up, of a chair, underneath the doorknob. We weren't entirely happy about it, but there was nothing happened. Now, next morning, we walked to the railway, and we boarded a train that took us to within 3 miles of the Swiss frontier. We could see the mountains towering above us, with snow-capped peaks over on the left. On this particular train, a uniformed fascist asked me for a match, but I knew the word for match, and I very quickly responded and gave him one, so there was no crisis there. When we eventually got off the train, we walked across country to the little smuggler's village of Tirano, which was our jumping off place for Switzerland. We must have looked a bit odd because we were still carrying our suitcases and we still had our town clothes on. And there we were, right out in the country, as it were. But most of the population of the village had been smugglers before the war. They'd smuggled contraband between Italy and Switzerland. They knew all the mountain paths, and our guide took us to the house of the two mountain guides who would escort us that night. During the day, we were hidden in a pigsty with the pigs. That was the safest place, I suppose. And while we were in the pigsty, we ate all our reserve food and rested. We didn't want to be carrying a lot of surplus food as weight. And that evening, we were taken into a house in the village. Here we had another meal. There was a roaring fire. After about a half an hour, a knock on the door, and standing in the doorway, an Italian in fascist uniform. So I looked at Tony, and he looked at me, and we thought the game was up. We'd got this far, and the game was up, but not so. Very good English, he said. Don't worry, I'm working for the underground. It's my job to ensure that the German frontier patrol will not be in your sector tonight when you cross. And then somebody said, can you sing? Asked us whether we could sing. We said we could. He said, because we're going to have a party here tonight. And so we had a sort of sing-song and drank far too much vino, really, under the circumstances. The Lambeth Walk went down very well, and so did one of Tony's rather fruity RAF songs. Everybody enjoyed themselves immensely. We all parted very good friends, went upstairs to have a little bit of a sleep. In no time at all, and in the early hours, it could have been 2 o'clock in the morning, there was a knock on the door. The route was clear, and we had to make a move. We both got hangovers to a certain degree because the wine was pretty rough, actually. I asked the guide how long, and all he would say was, soon you will be in Switzerland. That's all they ever would say. He didn't mention the fact that it was a 7,000-feet climb that we got to tackle, which is a hell of a long way. We had no idea that we were going to be taken over the Alps. Nobody had ever said that. There were people who went across the frontier at ground level, as it were. There was a Jewish woman who crawled through a sewer with her baby strapped to her back and gagged, who went across the frontier like that. We met her in the transit camp at St. Martin. But the safest way to go over was across the Alps. But as I say, we had no idea it was going to take as long as that, or that it would be as steep as that. I mean, the very first mountain path we came to was almost perpendicular in places. After a couple of hours, we both felt pretty groggy. Every time you went round a corner, there was another long path going straight up, as far as you could see almost, you know. And it seemed that we were never going to get to the top, or even get to a flat stretch. It was heartbreaking, really. After 3.5 hours, there was a small mountain stream. We managed to drink deeply from that. We got 2 or 3 very good mouthfuls. We were both feeling pretty rough by new by now. And we went on climbing until snow made an appearance on the mountainside. By now we were making quite frequent halts for rest, but the guides were urging us on. They said, in effect, we've got to get across the frontier as soon after daybreak as possible. That was the important thing. And although my wound had finally healed, my back was throbbing like it had done during the traipsing across the fields. And it was quite an effort to stagger to our feet after we'd had a rest. Now, the mountain paths that we were using, they were large round stones the size of cobblestones. We had thin Italian civilian shoes on, and the stones were biting right through the balls of our feet, and it was very painful. Tony was practically walking on his socks. At 8 o'clock in the morning, there was still some distance to go, and it was already light. The guides were worried and jumpy, so were we. We were flopping down quite regularly, pressing our faces into the snow and eating great mouthfuls of snow, which the guides were telling us was very bad for us, but we had reached that stage. And with 30 minutes of climbing to go, only 30 minutes, I flopped down. I was completely all in. I lay there and I didn't give a damn whether I died or whether I didn't. I had an extraordinary sort of fatigue that flowed over me, that flowed over me and completely engulfed me. Wasn't painful or anything. There was no pain at all, but I knew that if I closed my eyes and told the others to leave, I should go to sleep and I'd never wake up. And what I'll never forget is the feeling of utter contentment. I was quite, that was as nearest as I would have been to death, I think. I was in a frame of mind where I would have welcomed it. And maybe that's the way everybody gets, finally. But that's how it was. Complete and utter, at peace with everything and the world, contented. Must have been exhaustion, exactly. Exactly.
Were you cold as well?
Yeah, we were cold. It was cold up there. Snow was on the thing. Yes, it was cold. But this did happen to quite a lot of people who actually crossed the Alps without guides. They didn't stand a chance without guides. Anyway, what happened to me was that Tony kicked me. I owe my life to Tony, really. Dragged me to my feet. The guides got behind and pushed. Tony went in front and pulled. And that's how I got over the frontier. No barbed wire, no barricade, no fence, just tiny little red and white posts. That's all, about 18 inches, 2 feet high, I suppose.
No one guarding?
Nobody at all. The guide pointed, said one word, Switzerland. Tony turned round, shook hands with them. I did, to the best of my ability, although I was just about standing up. We turned out our pockets, we gave them everything we'd got, money, wristwatches. They waved goodbye and went back to get another batch, I suppose, to bring over. They were brave men. This was December the 3rd, 1943, exactly 2 months after the Modena Underground had found us. That's it. That one?
Then you went on down. Did you start going downwards?
Yes. Yeah, not so long, but it's we had an amusing time getting down, actually. Have we got room on there? Okay, we'll have a go. It wasn't an easy descent. It was very wooded. We kept to a path and had a hell of a shock. We thought we were going towards a Swiss guard hut, but the frontier kinked. We'd been warned about this by the guides. The guides had warned us, but we'd actually gone over the... We'd got very close to the frontier again, and we weren't very far from this either Italian or German guard hut, so we raced back up the path again and cut off into the trees. We used our suitcases as sleighs. We slid down through the trees, crashed into trees and bushes, bruised ourselves. Then we found a path leading to a Swiss village in the valley below. We could see the valley way down below us, although it was quite a long way. So we stopped at a farmhouse and a woman came to the door and Tony said to her, "We are English escapers," very proudly, "from Italy." And the woman looked at him and looked at me and she said, "Oh, really? You are the first two we've had today." Which completely put us down. We absolutely shattered because we had no idea at that time that so many people had got there. Anyway, she was jolly kind. She gave us a very good meal, and I remember goat milk to drink, dried our shoes, put us on the road to the village, and we thought it was tremendous to be free. We shouted at all the farm labourers, "Hello, how are you? We're English." And they shouted back and smiled. And then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we met the Swiss guard passing us on the way up the mountain. And the NCO stopped us, and he asked us if we'd come from Italy. "So, yes," said Tony, "we're English." "Were you stopped by our guards?" he said. "No," we said, we didn't see any Swiss guards. We avoided the Germans and the Italians and the Swiss." "Oh, goodness me," he said, "we're going to get in terrible trouble tonight for not spotting you." And they hadn't spotted us. And then 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we reached the actual village. We made for a house with a telephone. Woman answered the door. "Could we use her telephone?" She said, "Yes." We wanted to ring the British consul in Bern, I think it was. So we got through, but we spoke to the vice consul, and I was talking, and he said, "You'll have to report to the nearest Swiss military post. You will, of course, be interned." I said, "What? Interned?" He said, "Yes." He said, "You can't just, you know, you can't get out of Switzerland. You're in Switzerland now, and you're going to be interned." So I slammed the phone down, turned around and told Tony, and Tony said, "Oh, with that, we'll go back to Italy. We're not going to be interned." So we talked about it, and then we decided that it would be suicide to go back without the guides. And who were we going to contact in Switzerland to get us back? Whilst we were talking, the telephone rang again, and it was the British consul this time. He'd been in bed with a cold or something, but the vice consul had told him we'd slammed the phone down, and he'd phoned us up. And he said, "Don't do anything foolish." He said, "Don't try and get back to Italy and get to the 8th Army. He said, "You'll never make it from here. You won't even get across the mountains." He said, "There are hundreds of British already in Switzerland." He said, "You'll just have to put up with it with them for a while." So we talked it over, and we were told, and we decided to do what the consulate told us to do, give ourselves up. We walked along the road to the frontier post of Campo Colonia. We could see Germans and fascist frontier guards on the other side, and somehow we resisted the temptation to give them the V sign, which we wanted to do, but we didn't do that. We went into a little cafe, ordered a drink. The lady and her husband at the house had given us some money, and we were sitting there when two Swiss soldiers came up. One put his hand on Tony's shoulder and one put his hand on my shoulder, and one of the soldiers said, "You are English." We said, "Yes." So he said, "I'm afraid I must put you under arrest." And that's where we were arrested, actually, at the frontier post.
It all sounds as though the Swiss got quite used to having you.
Oh, I think so, yes.
Kind of in large numbers, and it was just an everyday matter to them.
I think it was an everyday thing, but of course there weren't big groups coming over, I don't think. I think there were pairs of people. But I think it was a pretty steady business, you know, with these smugglers, of course, making a bomb. I've no doubt they got something of that £100. They must have done. But we didn't see any money change hand with the villainous-looking youngster. But, I mean, the rest camp that we went to at St Maarten was something I will never forget. I mean, we, to us, the whole thing had been an adventure. But to these poor devils of Jews who'd come across the mountains, fleeing from certain death, they were so happy that they'd made it. I mean, we were happy that we'd made it, but it was nothing like them. I mean, they'd come away from certain death and that. There were a lot of them. There were German deserters. There was an Italian officer who had manned one of the two men submarines in Alexandria Harbour when they damaged the British warships. Tony had a long conversation with him, and I had a long conversation with an Italian woman who said, "Would you give me some advice?" She said, "You're English," and she spoke English quite well. I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, I have something in my suitcase. Could you tell me what I ought to do?" She opened the suitcase up. It was full of notes, English notes. You know, in those days, £50 and that sort of thing. God knows how much was in there. So I said to her, "Yes," I said, "you keep it and get it into a bank as soon as you can. It will be very valuable. It was in fact English currency. And then, as I say, there was this other woman who'd crawled through the sewer with a baby strapped to her back. And I must admit, we felt a little bit, I don't quite know which word to use, but I mean, these people had really suffered much more than we had. And it was marvellous to see them looking so pleased and happy. We stayed there the night, Saint Martin Rest Camp.
You mentioned the Italian fascist who was part of the smuggling operation on the border.
Oh yes, the guard.
Did you find out anything more about him?
Nothing more, no. No, no. We didn't see him again, actually.
He wasn't at that point.
No, he was making sure the Germans were somewhere else. Where we went over was completely clear. We were never in any risk of being captured, I don't think. These guys knew exactly what they were doing and exactly where to go. But they did get jumpy when we started keeling over, you know.
It's rather strange they haven't taken up sugar to keep you going.
I don't think anybody thought they might have done, but I don't.
But I mean, if they've been doing this,
yes, you would think so, because I mean we were not.
Might have realised that alcohol and a cold wind.
That's right.
And hard walking don't go together terribly well.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. Because I mean, there must have been others they'd had over who were much older than us too, much older than us. But, no, I think if we'd have known we were going to do 7,000 feet like that, and it was going to take as long as that, I don't think we'd have been quite so free with the alcohol the previous night. But nobody warned us, nobody told us. They were quite happy because everybody was singing. I think from Saman, the sort of setup in Switzerland was that as people arrived, they were sent to various villages. The British HQ was in Wiel, W-I-L, and they sort of masterminded it for that part of Switzerland. And we were sent to the little village of Lichtensteig, where there were several British officers, including the Queen's cousin, Archer Shee, I think it was. And the troops were billeted in houses and halls outside around the village, and they were extremely well looked after by the Swiss townspeople. They gave them a marvellous time. In fact, quite a lot of évadés de guerre, as we were called, married in Switzerland. And when the time came to come out, they left their Swiss wives behind. But that's how it worked. We had these, we were living in the hotel. And the money, we were paid regularly every week by funds through the British consul. We also very quickly found out that we could open bank accounts with the Union Bank of Switzerland and Lombard Odier, provided you'd got somebody to recommend you, and you could have a little bank account and raise the odd loan every now and then. So we didn't go without money.
What was the cost of living like?
It was pretty, I'd say it was quite expensive, actually. I don't think it was cheap.
When you say you got money through the consul, was this your army pay?
No, it wasn't your it was based on your army pay, I think. In other words, we probably got more as officers than some of the NCOs did, but it wasn't the actual army pay. I think it had got to come, I think, from some special fund, I imagine. I don't know. I just know that we got so much every week. I can't remember what it was now. How much? Well, our living costs were pretty low, really, because we ate in the Kroner Hotel. The food was supplied free to us because the hotel had to pay the British consul, I suppose, or the British government. So our accommodation was provided free by the government and a certain amount of spending money. Now, here we were helped because all the drinks that the hotel owner, who was very, very friendly towards the British, had got down in the cellar, he sold them all to us at cost price. So the gin and the whiskey and the sherry and what have you was all bought by us at cost price. So we were always able to sit down after dinner. When we'd listen to the 9 o'clock news, we used to go down into the restaurant and sit and knock back a few before we went to bed.
Were there any restrictions upon your range of movement?
Yes, very much so. You couldn't, if you wanted to go into Zurich or Bern or anywhere, you had to have a very good reason and you had to have a pass to get in there. That was in the early stages. But I was very fortunate because a man named Desmond Young, Brigadier Desmond Young, who wrote the Rommel book after the war, came round to the various detachments, we called them, where we were, asked if there was anybody with journalistic experience. So I immediately put my hand up. I didn't think this was a bad one to volunteer for. And he said, I want someone to be assistant editor to a newspaper we're going to publish every week for a Vardediger, and it's going to be called Marking Time. So we published this 12-page newspaper. A lot of the news was translated from French into English. We got it from Reuters in Bern, I think. And, of course, I was able to move about quite a lot then. I was able to move over to the printers. I was able to go into Zurich at weekends, and so was Desmond. So we were really very fortunate, and we had more freedom of movement in Switzerland than almost anybody other than the Evade band, which we made up a band of chaps, British and Australians, and that used to go around to all the different villages where they were billeted, and Adel Boden when they went on holiday, and that, giving band shows, and Zurich.
Who actually issued these passes? Was that the Swiss police authority?
Yes, I can show you one in a minute. They were quite... that would have been issued... I mean, Desmond was very much under the control of the Swiss authorities. We had to be very careful what we published in the paper, and we didn't have to overstep the line either, otherwise they came down like a ton of bricks. Reason being that they were frightened of the Germans anyway, and they thought, well, if we publish a newspaper over here by British Evades and it is too anti-German in any way, it'll give the Germans an excuse to invade us. One excuse in many, of course, to invade us if they wanted to. And it wasn't until the end of our time in Switzerland that we were really allowed to move around freely, when there was no longer any danger from the Germans. Prior to that, if we did go into Zurich, little tiny Union Jack in the lapel of our jacket was all that we were allowed to wear.
So you were in civilian clothes?
Civilian clothes the whole time, yes. Except at the detachments, people wore their battle dress there, in the villages and that, where they were billeted.
No physical security?
None at all, none at all. We were interned, evaders of the war, for what it's worth, that's what they called it, evade de guerre. But as I say, you were not allowed to move out of the place unless you had permission to do so.
Were